All right, are we ready?
Yep.
Okie doke. Start for a second here.
It helps to have everything in sync.
Okay, let's start with our third session on Saturday. This is session number 9 overall. We'll take a lunch break and we'll come back and have 3 sessions after that. So this is where we ended at the end of our last class, talking about Herod and what Herod was doing and how much Herod was doing his best to curry favor with both Rome and the Jews in and around the land of Judea. And that's going to require a constant balancing act. And he did it fairly well for a long period of time. So what we did at the very end of the class is we want to talk about Roman influence. And I'm going to go outside of these slides to look at something else to give you a little fuller picture in this session. So we've gone longer in multiple sessions, so we may go a little shorter in this one if we get this done in time. We'll see how that works. But I want us to understand not just the history of the Jews that led them into captivity, the history of the Jews that brought them out of captivity, God's workmen in this context, Cyrus, prophesied by Isaiah, issued the decree that allowed them to go back to the land of Canaan and to reestablish everything. Providentially, they were provided for by means of the directive of Cyrus, the king of Persia. They were also provided for by means of the workers that he sent, by means of the resources that he provided. So God's hand's involved in all that, and God said they would bring them back. Isaiah said the remnant would return. Jeremiah anticipated their return after 70 years. So all that's historical. We saw the development of the redo of everything in the worship system, and the redo of the priesthood, all that stuff goes to the end of the Old Testament. And then we stopped and we got into the work of Alexander yesterday. And so that's the beginning of the period between the Testaments. And we went through Alexander after Persian rule. Some of that bleeds over from Old Testament into the intertestamental period. All of Alexander's rule is in the time of the intertestamental period. And then we saw the influence of Rome. And the influence of Rome is 100 years before Pompey comes on the scene. So that's 163, 164 years before the New Testament opens, if we're going to use year zero roughly, and just using that as a point of demarcation. And so that's nearly 200 years before Christ is going to be crucified. And so Rome bridges that period from the intertestamental period into the New Testament. So we're right at the edge of that when we went through everything from Pompey through Antipas and through Antipater, and then we get to Herod, who's literally this a crossing point into the age of the New Testament, especially with reference to his descendants. So in order to make sense of how this stuff worked specifically, not just broadly on an empire scale, and not just less broadly, but still broad than what's going on day-to-day affairs in the life of citizens in Rome and citizens in and around Judea, I want us to look at these two chapters from this text. Now, I mentioned this book. This one I like that I've used a lot because it, and this is not an insult to anybody's intelligence, it's very accessible and very easy, very narrative written. This one's much more encyclopedic. It's easy to read. It's got lots of charts, lots of graphs, lots of pictures or diagrams, but it's also incredibly researched. For example, I just flipped this open in the middle. This is nothing but footnotes, all right? So it's easily readable, but it's highly documented, much more than this one is. I'm not saying this provides no documentation. At the end of each chapter, it'll say further reading, and I'll have 4 or 5 resources. This one has scads and scads of resources. So if you know who Bruce Metzger is, he was a professor at Princeton Seminary for many, many years, involved in lots of work that are cited by scholars today in New Testament studies and the study of textual transmission of the New Testament and so forth. He wrote an incredible introduction to this. So this guy may not be very well known, Albert Bell. I was about to call him Alexander Bell. Albert Bell. But if you run across this, I own it in print form, as you see, and you're about to see it on the screen in digital form. I like digital form for teaching, but I like print form because I like to hold a book in my hand when I go to bed at night. I write all over most of them. And so I like it both. But it's a very accessible text. So I mentioned it's got lots of images, lots of pictures, lots of charts. There'll be lots of breakout things like this. So it's a very usable text. And so this one I like is good from the standpoint of a nice flow. This one's even more in-depth than that. And so the other things I showed you pictures of are at the beginning that are listed on the bibliography that are valuable. So I'm going to segue from this now, and I'm going to go to that particular text. So this is the digital version of this text, and it's this chapter that we mentioned before called The Powers That Be. Now you can't see it very well, but this is highlighted on my screen. The brightness and the contrast is there. So here's what I want us to understand is how Roman power translated into stuff that personally, directly, touched the lives of the Jews. All right, so I'm going to read through some of this, and I'm putting it on the screen so you can read it with me. There's nothing worse sometimes than having something read to you and you can't follow along. So I want you to follow along. I'm going to stop and talk about it along the way. All right, so the New Testament, that's what we're really wanting to get to. So no, this is a book about New Testament background. It's called Exploring the New Testament World. But exploring the New Testament world means exploring the intertestamental world that existed before the New Testament world, because what happened in the centuries before the New Testament came on the scene helps, determine how the New Testament's going to play out. So that's why we're looking at this. The New Testament, look at the language, is anchored firmly in the political processes of the first century before Jesus. That's Herod. That's Herod's daddy, Antipater. That's Herod's grandfather, Antipas. That's the whole Maccabean system. That's the whole Roman system. And actually, it goes back not just one century, but multiple centuries before. So roots of what affected the New Testament starts at the end of the close of the Old Testament and goes forward. So you got a 6-century span from the time that they released from Babylon, 536, to the time the temple is going to be destroyed at 70. So that's almost 600 years exactly, just about that, in which that period of time is all should be considered as one contiguous unit. So the New Testament is anchored firmly in the political processes. Of the first century before Christ, Jesus sanctioned obedience to the government. Which government? It was the Roman government. This Roman government? He said, obey the government? Paul does the same thing, Romans 13. So that's in Mark 12, at least in certain spheres, and confronted Agrippa and Pilate during his trials. All right, Agrippa was one of the Herod families. Paul, a Roman citizen, argued that the Roman government existed with the approval of God. Well, those people are on our side, but you don't do anything the government says you can't do or do anything beyond that. You don't omit or commit sins, go beyond or fall short of, unless it's obeying God first. And that's where the apostles, when they were called on the carpet by the priests, said, we told you not to preach anymore in this man's name. You're bringing his blood upon us. He says, we ought to obey God rather than man. All right? So at that point, there's a principle of violation conscience before God that if they tell you to do something that God tells you do what God says. All right? That's part of the problem that the Jews faced during the period of the Hasmoneans, the Maccabeans, where the Seleucid guy, Antiochus IV, said, no, you do what we tell you to do and don't offer worship to God. We got an issue there. You just told me I can't do what God wants me to do, and I'll die before I do that. And that's exactly what Mattathias said, and that's what his son stood for. All right. Now they went overboard in some things and enforcing Judaism and compelling people to become Jews later. But their initial desire and the initial intent was, we're not going to obey you. We're going to do what God said. So we'll go into hiding if we have to. All right. You can come after us if you want to, but we're not going to offer sacrifices to pagan gods. All right. So perfectly within God's right, from God's perspective, to do so. That's Jesus upheld government. So did Paul. Christians should be submissive to it. Titus 3:1. In the course of his brushes with the government, he's talking about Paul now, stood before governors. Gallio, Felix, Festus, or client kings. Notice the language there? Client kings. What does that mean? They are serving somebody else. If he's called a client king, that means he only became king because somebody else made him king. So Herod, as powerful as he was a client king of Rome. This Herod Agrippa was even a king over a lesser area. But Herod the Great was still a client king because Rome made him king. He didn't become king by conquering Judah on his own and by amassing his own army. He became king because Rome, the larger empire, allowed him to be king here. So he was a client king as well. So the point is, you know, this is what Jesus dealt with. This is what Paul dealt with. Paul was waiting a hearing before a court in Rome when last we hear of him, other New Testament authors ran afoul of the Roman government as well. Peter speaks of being imprisoned in Babylon. That's a Christian symbolic name used with reference to Rome, a code name, as he says. And the author of the Revelation had been exiled, that's John the Apostle, by the government into a small Mediterranean island, that's Patmos, all right, when he saw his vision. Luke's primary purpose in writing was to convince one Theophilus, and the ending of his name, U.S., tells us it's more likely to be a Gentile Roman name than a Jewish name. And so, apparently, he was an official of some kind, and the take is he's probably a Roman official. So his point is, this is what I'm going to tell you about the faith that we have, the faith that all of us believe in, and let me provide the evidence for that. That the new faith was no threat to the established order. Jesus didn't come to depose Rome, all right? There is nothing in any age during which Christianity should be following what God wants them to do in which it requires you to turn upside down the government, all right? Jesus didn't say, you know, kick Rome out of control, kick these people out of control, whatever. Be faithful. I saw something the other day, listening to a radio broadcast on the way here. I was on the way home last night. I make use of my time sometimes. I was listening to radio broadcast, and they were interviewing people who are of Catholic background in the state of Nevada. And they were interviewing these people because, generally speaking, most Catholics are very much pro-life, anti-abortion. And they said, how is what's going on politically in your state? This is all the Democratic caucuses and stuff that's going on the last few days, and the caucus actually takes place today. How is this affecting what your faith requires of you? And the last man they interviewed, he said, I don't care who becomes president, I still have to be a faithful Catholic. Well, change Catholic to what we would understand to be more consistent with New Testament Christianity. Jesus, in effect, wants his disciples to say the same thing. I don't care who's emperor. I don't care who's procurator. I don't care who is the governor of this land or that land. I don't care who runs the city council. I don't care what the Sanhedrin says or the Pharisees say or the Sadducees say. I still want you to be my kingdom disciple. So who is in control is absolutely irrelevant with reference to our responsibility in the first century and in every century since then. And that's what Mattathias said. We don't care what you tell us to do. We don't care that if your ancestors politically and you're the successor of one of the generals of Alexander, we don't care. We're not going to do anything that God doesn't want us to do, and we're not to fail to do what God does want us to do. We're going to do. So the point is, this is the principle. We will do anything that we can do to comply with you, but we are not going to not do what God wants. We're not going to refrain from doing that, and we're not going to, you can't make us, you know, change. And so that's the whole we obey God rather than man. So here's the mindset here. Even though he is exiled, John's still going to write what he needs to write to encourage Christians to be faithful. So Theophilus is encouraged, saying, this is not a threat to you. You can be the most malevolent dictator, whatever. I'm still going to be Christ. You may kill me, but I'm not going to not be Christ. All right? That's not a 21st century political thing. That's not a 21st century religious thing. That's just a God thing all the time. That's a God thing all the time. And so we always have to be faithful. It would seem then that to understand the New Testament world, we must know at least in outline how its government worked. Not just it has power. Not just here's how it gathered taxes. Not just this king, that governor, this procurator, but how does it work when you get down to daily lives? What did Rome say you could and couldn't do that affected your daily life? All right? How did it affect, you know, how you did business? How did it affect family? How did it do all that? So that's what this chapter is designed to do. And I'm not going to read through all of that, but I wanted to bring this out because in the next chapter, it literally talks about how Roman law worked. How did Roman law work? Well, how it worked is part of what we discussed before about they were more concerned with their legal laws than they were religious laws. And they didn't care what you did religiously as long as it didn't violate their particular law. So I'm going to scroll through this very quick to get to the next chapter. This particular chapter talks about how the government came into being. It talks about the establishment of the Caesars. And it talks about the Pax Romana that we talked about before after the defeat of Antony and the next second triumvirate, and Augustus, who was first called Octavian, the nephew of Caesar, came into power. And so it goes through the same stuff that we did, only it slows down and it starts talking about Augustus as it impacted. Let me go back here very quickly. Augustus's name, I didn't mention his dates here, but he's going to be a ruler until about 16 or so, and then Tiberius is the next ruler. I said 16, 13. Tiberius comes on in the play. So in Luke, let's do this very quickly. Look at Luke chapter 2. And so I'm not going to go through this other than use it as a jumping off point to get to the next chapter that is critical. So if you're in the book of Luke, this is part one, the sequel to Acts. Or the prequel to Acts, I should say. Got that wrong. So when you look at Luke chapter 2, it says, it came to pass in those days that a decree went out from Caesar Augustus. That's Octavian. And he's called Augustus because the Roman Senate gave him that name. You are our august, reverential, preferred great hero. All right? That this decree went out. All right? So that's when Jesus was going to be born in this context. Now go to the next chapter. And in one chapter, 52 verses later, we've jumped 30 years in the future, right? So notice the date on this. Tiberius is going to become the next emperor at 14. What does this say in chapter 3, verse 1? Now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius. What does that mean? You add 15 to this, you're talking about AD 29. This is about the beginning of John's ministry, immediately followed by Jesus' ministry. So the next emperor, this is the guy, he's mentioned by name, Luke chapter 3, verse 1. The first real Caesar is mentioned by name in Luke chapter 2, verse 1. The only reason I'm bringing this out is to show that Luke pays attention to all the people who are in positions of authority. Now, go back to chapter 2, verse 1, and it says Caesar Augustus is the Caesar, but it took place during the time when Quirinius was governing Syria. Where's Syria? That's where Antiochus came from. That's the area that the Seleucids reigned. So notice, remember, I did this every time I had to turn around. Here's Syria up here, right? Palestine's here, and here's Egypt. Syria. This guy is over Syria. Why is it mentioned Syria? Because Syria had a lot of impact and tension when Seleucids were in control and Antiochus was in control. But then it goes on, and it talks about the census that's going to take place. Now look at chapter 3. It's going to go into more detail. Chapter 3, in the 15th year of this guy, Tiberius. 15th year of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate. Why is it mentioned Pilate? Because he's still going to be on the scene when Jesus goes to trial. So this is about 3 years before Jesus goes to trial. This is about the beginning of John's ministry that's going to begin in just a minute. So look at all the political guys that are mentioned. Tiberius Caesar, he's the emperor. Pontius Pilate is governor of Judea. Herod, watch this, being tetrarch of Galilee. Tetrarch means he's ruler over a fourth part. Ethnarch means he's ruler over a half part. Herod the Great was ruler of the whole shooting match. So after Herod died, the kingdom is going to be split up among some of his descendants, his sons, but they don't rule on a scale as large as he did. Herod being tetrarch over Galilee, his brother Philip tetrarch, there's another quarter of Iturea, in the region of Trachonitis, and Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene. All right? So all these guys got quarter, quarter, quarter. Annas, watch this. Annas and Caiaphas being high priest. We don't have time to go all into all this, but how do you have two guys being high priest at the same time? Just a reminder, during the time of the Hasmoneans, you've got Aristobulus and Hyrcanus, the second Aristobulus and the second Hyrcanus, vying for contention to be high priest at the same time. And we're not even sure that we know that they're descendants in the line of Levi, but we don't know that they were descendants of the high priest. So here's my point. Mr. Luke ties all of this stuff to Roman officials. Why does he do that? Because they're going to have something to say when Jesus' trial comes up. Because Mr. Pilate's going to be involved in this, and Mr. Herod, the one that's mentioned here, is going to be involved in this. So that's why we're seeing the roots of what's going on here. And I'm going to go through this very quickly to get to the actual law. So these are the following kings. This is Caligula. He's the guy who assumed to be called a god while he was alive. I don't want you to declare me to be a god after I die like you did Augustus, like you're going to do to Tiberius. Just call me a god now. So he is often referred to as crazy Caligula. Claudius is the one mentioned by name in the book of Acts because he drove all the Jews out of the city of Rome. But when he drove the Jews out of Rome, guess who else got banned from Rome? Christians. Why? Because from everybody's perspective, the Christians were nothing but a sect of the Jews. And so sometimes you'll see it refers to the sect of the Nazarenes. They're follower of a particular Jew from Nazareth, a Nazarene called Jesus. Well, they're just part of the Jews. They didn't distinguish between them. So that's this guy, Claudius. Then we get into Nero. Nero's the guy who persecuted Christians. And it's probably during Nero's reign that both Peter and Paul were in prison, if not actually killed. And so Mr. Nero is not a very good guy. Very quickly, we're going to jump ahead to the Flavians. So there's a dynasty change. When the Jews, notice the time here, 69. A couple years before this, the Jews, the Zealots, are going to attack the Roman garrison in the city of Jerusalem. Immediately before this, it's not going to mention all their names, but there were three guys who were emperor in the space of 1 year, Galba, Otho, and Vitellius. And so the Roman Senate says, we got some major problems here. We can't have a consolidated emperor last long enough. We have three guys in 1 year. So this guy, Mr. Vespasian, was the general of the army who is called to quell the uprising of the Jews in the city of Jerusalem. And so they call him, said, you need to come back. We want you to be the emperor. So he leaves, and his son, Titus, is going to remain. So what Vespasian starts, Titus finishes, and they laid siege to the city of Jerusalem and destroyed the city of Jerusalem and the temple never to be rebuilt. To this day, 2,000 years later, the temple's not rebuilt. Incidentally, if you look in the pictures, you can go to images.google or just do a search for it and do a search for the Ark of Victory that bears Titus's name in Rome. All right, that's the Titus who's the son of Vespasian. Vespasian's called back to be the emperor. He's a general now. And so he is here fighting against the Jews to quell the insurrection by the Jews. All right, here's the Zealots, who are the political successors. They may not have been the physical in the seed line of the Hasmoneans, the Maccabeans, but they said, what those guys did, we want to do. We'll drive the Romans out. They got rid of the Seleucids, but they didn't get rid of the Romans. The Romans came and squashed them. All right. So Vespasian goes back, and his son Titus is going to continue. The reason why I brought him up, Titus, when he loots the temple and all of its treasures, some of those treasures end up going to the city of Rome and funding architecture and building projects in the city of Rome, one of which was the arch that builds his name. That's what many scholars understand. So notice, Vespasian's going to become the next emperor. And then we see emperors after that bearing his name, Titus, and then Domitian during the time of Book of Revelation. Now, this is also going to mention all about the governors. Here's Pompey, who was a general, who was also a governor, brought Judea under control. This is their view. I'm not going to go into all this because we did some of this before. And then we get to the issue of the Herods. All right. This is Herod the Great and all his descendants too. Mr. Pilate's going to be discussed. Why? Because he comes into play. This is Paul dealing with Roman procurators and governors and client kings. Sergius Paulus, Gallio and Seneca. He was a Roman official in AD 52 is mentioned in the text. And then we're going to jump way down. There's Felix, Festus, and Agrippa. He's the one who was governor when the census was given. Now, I'm going to go through all of this because this is really incredibly important, but I want to get to this part right here. Notice this is all the documentation. I told you it's an easy read, but he's very heavily documented. Here's what I want us to understand. All right? In the time that we're going to take before we break for lunch, I want us to understand why what happened during Jesus' trial happened. It was according to Roman law. Now notice, can it be read clear enough? Can you see it fairly well? I mean, I can make it bigger if I need to.
It's fine.
Huh? It's okay?
Yeah.
So look at this. While the dispute between the Christians and the Jews was theological, watch this. Christians, Jews, it's a theological issue. Christians, Romans, not a theological issue. Jews, Romans, not a theological issue. The Jews and the Christians were on the same page, and they were talking about what was right from God's perspective. That's why it's called theological. That's not the Romans' issue. It's not a theology thing for them. We don't care what you believe theologically about your God or any God. We want to know, are you breaking our law? That's it. All right? So it wasn't law equals morals or morals equal law. They were distinct. Our system of morals isn't your system of morals, so we're dealing with legals. So notice, between the Christians and Jews was theological, but between the Christians and the Romans, it was all about law. Roman law. Roman law. Not your law, but Roman law. Yet when we say that, we must remember that the ancient mind did not distinguish as clearly as we try to do between religion and politics. Pilate did not interrogate Jesus about his doctrine. When he left the high priest, every question the priests were asking Jesus was about, what do you believe doctrinally, theologically? Pilate, when he came into his court, says, well, tell me about your religious belief system. He didn't give 2 cents about that. He didn't care. It's not that he didn't know. It's not that he wasn't aware of the ideas of the Jews. But remember, Pilate's there under the auspices of Rome. And Romans got Pilate there to keep peace, keep the law in force, enacted, and everything on an even keel. You can believe the moon's made out of green cheese, but as long as you don't do anything to disrupt the Roman Empire, you may be crazy, but we're not going to put you in jail. And so he says, I don't find anything that this guy's worthy of death. Why? He didn't violate a Roman law. Didn't violate a Roman law. And he didn't violate anything God's law, except that the Jews thought he did, because they couldn't stand the fact that he claimed to be the Son of God. He really was, but that upset their apple cart because it was a theological distinction. They didn't believe that. So Pilate didn't interrogate Jesus about doctrine. So that's an incredible shift. Incredible shift. All right? All the condemnation from the Jews, no condemnation from Pilate. Why? Two totally systems of measuring stuff. One was God stuff, the other one was law stuff, Roman law stuff. That was what the Sanhedrin had focused on, especially the issue of blasphemy. Pilate's questions to Jesus reflect the governor's concern, notice that, with the possibility of a revolt. That's it. If you're not going to revolt against Rome, I don't care what you say. All right? You know, you can wear the stupidest stuff, say the stupidest stuff, behave in erratic manners, but as long as you're not inciting a rebellion, everything's okay. If Jesus was claiming to be the king of the Jews, that's what the Jews were so upset about, there was a basis for a charge of treason against him. Why? Because if he's a king, he's going to cause a rebellion. But he wasn't that kind of king. He was a spiritual king. But it would be politically and not religiously motivated. So the king that Jesus was going to be was a spiritual king, not a political military king. And his kingdom wasn't of this world. So are you a king then? Well, yeah. Well, are you going to take over the world? No, that's not that kind of kingdom. So again, totally different orientation. After Pilate determined that the charge that the Jews made was groundless, he was willing to release Jesus. Why? Different standards. You say, this is right or wrong? That's not what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about Roman law. If it's wrong according to Roman law, okay. Then the judgment's going to be pronounced. All right? But he was willing to release Jesus with perhaps a beating to warn him not to say anything, keep his mouth shut. He needed to appease the Jews. That was the only thing that made him give in to their clamor and order Jesus to be crucified. Pilate gave in to keep the peace, not because he thought Jesus was guilty of anything. All right? So here's the Roman law. Remember, going back to the Greeks, you do whatever you want. We don't care. Just don't mess up anything. The Romans, the same thing. So what we've been saying, you know, repeatedly in the course of our discussion of what happens in the intertestamental period, this is why Jesus died. Not because he violated a Roman law, but because the Roman procurator and the Roman governors and the Roman kings, all of the puppets of the Rome that were in place, the client kings and governors and so forth, didn't want to do anything to upset Rome. And so they had to keep the peace, even if it required an innocent man to die. The Romans had no genuine religious convictions. The next chapter in this text, we're not going to look at it, talks about that. It makes no difference to us what you do, as long as you don't violate legal principles in the city of Rome, in Rome, we're okay. So this whole chapter talks about Greek and Roman religion. They tolerated anything. They tolerated anything. Well, if they tolerated anything, and what Jesus taught was something in the realm of anything, they would be okay with that, as long as it didn't violate their principles. So when you read all this stuff, this is talking about all the different cults and beliefs in deities, miracles, magic, holy men, astrology, animism, which believes that everything is inherited with spirits. This table has a spirit, that wall has a spirit, and so forth. They didn't care. That's a ridiculous belief system, but we don't care. Why? Because it doesn't bother us. So the chapter on Greco-Roman religion is how far they reached in what they tolerated. And so if they tolerated all of that stuff, they're definitely going to tolerate this. There's been a history of toleration for what the Jews believe for centuries in the land of Palestine by the Romans. All right. So what Jesus is doing, this is 33 years, this is 100 years since Pompey, and 100 years before when Judas and then his brother Jonathan And then his brother Simon all said, protect us. They said, fine, we'll protect you. It's not your theology we're interested in. We're just trying to keep everything smooth. So for 200 years, what Pilate's doing here is consistent. It's not an issue. Again, when you look at this chapter, I'm not going to go into it. He simply said, that's not a violation of what we do. All right. Romans had no particular religious conviction. And again, when you look at the text, it talks about everything they tolerated, some very far out stuff. When they encountered a new cult or form of worship, they were interested only in its origins and behavior patterns and the effect which those aspects of it would have on the larger community. All right? There are particular religions that think you have to offer animal sacrifices. Okay, fine. All right? We have to kill X. We have to kill Y, whatever it might be. I said, well, is that going to do anything to disrupt Roman influence? No, we just kill animals as part of our worship. We don't care. You know, as long as you're not stealing them from somebody else, or you're not causing an uproar, or you kill animals in part to give you some kind of supernatural power that's going to cause you to take on the world, we don't care. You know, we don't care if you eat earthworms, swallow goldfish. We don't care. All right? My point is, they were incredibly open. And so they were incredibly tolerant. They were only interested if it's going to impact where they were. That's where the line between religion and politics became blurred. Persecution of a cult would be undertaken if the government deemed the group dangerous, watch this, to the life of the state. It's going to affect Rome or something that Rome's in control of, then we're going to step in. If it was revolutionary or if it was disruptive of the social order. I made reference to France many times because France practices this kind of philosophy. I don't care what you believe. I don't care if you're a radical Muslim and what you're going to do is going to kill people. We're not happy with that. If you want to be a Muslim all day long, we don't care. But you're French first. You assimilate first because you keep what's going on in the state even. So the moment somebody does something that's going to challenge French authority and going to violate what's going on in the state, they're going to say something. That's the Romans. Same thing. They don't care how wild it is. The cult of Dionysus, for example, encouraged its devotees, mostly women, to drink to excess, okay, might have some problems here, and to run through the countryside shrieking and chasing small animals, which would be torn apart and eaten raw. Now that's kind of strange. All right?
That's gross.
Well, it is. But the Romans banned it after its soon appearance out of fear that it might create such secretive night assemblies that might give rise to an unseen plot. Well, that's kind of strange. All right? So, but they didn't care what you did. Their concern was, is it going to be disruptive to the tranquility of the state? That's their issue. Religious groups suspected of engaging in criminal activities could also draw the government's wrath. Josephus, in his Antiquities, is cited here, records that a man named Mundus bribed the priests of Isis to connive in the seduction of a Roman matron who had resisted all his overtures. So he's interested in a woman. She doesn't like the guy, so he's going to bribe the priest of Isis. That's another cult. Can you do something to get this woman to be interested in me? When the plot was uncovered, the emperor Tiberius tore down that temple. Why? Because it's causing disruption. You're creating ripples in the smoothness of the lake in which we're living. They dumped the cult's idol in the Tiber River and ran the priest out of town. All right? So this is a weird kind of group of people. There's a little bit of disruption. We're going to stop. Jesus wasn't causing this kind of disruption. He was changing the way people lived. He was changing. He wanted them to think right. He wanted them to speak right. He wanted them to live right. You don't take up arms against anybody else. You live peaceably with all men as much as possible. You even submit to, notice that, you even submit to the government. Now, how can we charge somebody with insurrection if they say submit to the powers that be? That's a Jesus thing. That's a Paul thing. The only exception was when you tell me I can't do what God says I have to do. I'm gonna take issue with that. And it's not like the Romans didn't know that. They knew what the Maccabeans did in running Seleucid successors out of town. So this is the issue. Religious doctrine was not the issue. Criminal behavior was. The Jews, perhaps deemed guilty by association because of their Eastern religions, were expelled when the Christians were kicked out of town, when these others were, because they thought, you might be upsetting what's going on in Rome. And so, but it was a political thing. It was not a religious thing. It was an open question to the Romans whether some religious groups were by nature criminal or whether commission of specific crimes had to be proved against their members. The most serious charge brought against the Christians, however, was simply they refused to be loyal citizens and to prove their loyalty by performing ritual acts. This is what's going on in the latter part of the first century under the aegis of Domitian, who is the second son of Vespasian. Remember, Vespasian was the general who starts to quell the dissension by the Jews against the Roman army in Jerusalem. He's called back to be emperor, and his son Titus takes over. All right, Titus is the next emperor, and then Domitian. Domitian and some of the people operating under his authority in Asia Minor, if you don't offer sacrifices to our gods, then we're suspicious of you. Right, that's exactly what Antiochus was imposing. So you prove your loyalty by performing these ritual acts, whether they believed in them or not. Just do it. And this is what Antiochus said: just do it, and we'll be okay. Some of the Jews said, we can't do it. Even if we do it, saying to you, this means nothing to me, we're not going to do it. All right? Can you say God doesn't exist? Yeah, I can say it, but do you mean it? No. All right? Can you offer a sacrifice to this God? Yeah, I can do it. Do you mean it? No. Well, just do it anyway. And some of the Jews did it, but some of the Jews said, no way, no way. And so that's what enraged some people. Many philosophers of their time belittled the gods as outmoded superstition. So here's one of the reasons why they said, all this God stuff is ridiculous anyway. We're not going to charge anybody with a crime, regardless of how ridiculous we believe their gods are. All right. So they didn't buy into that. So in modern terms, they were willing to salute the flag. You don't believe in the flag, we don't care, just do it anyway. Christians weren't willing to do that. Christians appeared to the general public and to the government as a deviant, dangerous group. Not all the time. The Jews were okay. Remember, the Jews would point to followers of Christ saying, look, he's a king. He's going to overtake and overthrow Caesar. That was disingenuous. They knew that wasn't the case. All right. That was why the Romans took action against them. Romans insisted on state regulation of interference in the affairs of religious groups because for them, religion was a function of civic life, not private life. All right? If you do something publicly that's going to disrupt things, we're going to speak up. Any religious group, this is interesting, needed state approval to operate legally. This is one of the things that's done in China. If you don't have authority to be a religion, you can't do what you're doing. But they will allow lots of things to be religious. Some people are clamping down on that even now. But if you have the state approval, we don't care. Any union or guild or tradesman, they had to have approval. No unlicensed group could incorporate itself, maintain a treasury, do stuff in public. Christianity's problem in the first century was getting the legal authority to do so. But by this is later. This is late in the first century. This is not what's going on in the time of Jesus. Judaism was recognized and Judaism was tolerated. All right? For a long time, that was the case, for hundreds of years. That's going to change because Christians were very, very overt in their evangelism, and they caught the attention of a lot of people. So that's going to bring some persecution. So at this point, they were recognized as a cult. All right? Christianity's problem was they didn't seek benefit, which enjoyed a sectarian Judaism, a cult which had long since come to hold a privileged status among the religions of the empire. And so this is an issue here. We want you to assimilate. Now, I'm not going to go into this, but if you look at Trajan, Trajan is an emperor at the end of the first and the beginning of the second century. And there are letters that he writes back and forth between Pliny and Trajan about how to deal with these people who are called Christians. And so he writes a letter to the emperor, says, I got all these people claiming to be Christians. What do I do with them? I've never attended a trial for the Christians. They're claiming to be something different. How do we deal with this? And Pliny writes back to him and said, as long as they submit to Roman rule, let them do whatever they want. But if they're going to object to submitting to us, then you can enforce some kind of punishment. And so this is 80 years after the time of Jesus. My point is, what's going on in this context, I'm going to go back to the slide if I can find it here. What's going on in this context is the powers that be, the Roman officials, were more concerned about Roman law and their legal perspective than they were about what any God said. Your God to us is just any God, just another God. As long as what you do doesn't conflict with our laws, we don't care what it is. So it was legal, 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 not theological, 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 until your theology impacts how we do law. When your theology impacts how we do law, we're going to say something. All right? So for a large period of time, until 50s, 60s or so, for the next 30 years, Christianity didn't have any problems in the law, unless, you know, somebody, you know, got a burr under their saddle, they didn't like something, but it was tolerated for a while. Now, for the next 2.5 centuries until the early 300s, Christianity is going to be persecuted because they considered them a challenge to the empire, but not initially, and not based upon existing, so to speak, under the coattails of Judaism. But then, in the early 300s, Christianity was tolerated, and then it became the official religion. So a total different change. And that did more damage to Christianity than anything else because the Romans got involved in that. All right, we're going to do a shorter section now because we've gone longer before. On the other side of the break, we're going to devote time to dealing with the issue of the writings that took place during the time between the Testaments and how they are to be regarded. All right, so we've gone just about 40 minutes in this section, which is fine. We've gone much longer in the other sections, and so we'll stop now, take a break, and we have three sessions to go after this. All right, any questions before we break? All right, thank you so much. We'll stop now.